Good morning. Thank you for inviting me here. I should start with an apology. This talk that I'm giving on Saturday morning, first of all, I don't give talks on Saturday morning. But this talk is going to be completely non-technical. I was not sure who the audience is going to be. As I go through some of the slides and the analysis, I will try to highlight what research drives some of the concepts that I'm going to present. But the talk here requires no knowledge of supply chain, no knowledge of logistics. It's a talk about some of my experience implementing effective supply chain strategies that look mostly at risk. So here is what I am going to cover. I will start with today's supply chain challenges, then focus on two types of strategies, those that deal with managing the unknown, and those that deal with managing the known unknown. In this process, I will introduce two concepts. One is redundancy, and the other one is flexibility. Both are intuitively clear. When you talk to people in industry, everybody understands that more flexibility is better than less. The problem is that flexibility, much like redundancy, they do not come free. So the question is, how much redundancy one needs, how much flexibility you need, where to invest in each one of them, and what is the potential benefit of these types of strategies. And then I will summarize with key takeaways. The books that you see on the right-hand side are either MBA textbooks or books on business strategies for business professionals. Not presented here is the technical book that I wrote that focus on the foundation, right? But from time to time, I'll mention some of the results here. All right, so I'm sure you're familiar with some of the challenges that I have here. Global supply chain with very long lead time, manufacturing is in low-cost countries, market demand a lot of time is in Europe and in North America, as a result, long lead time. Rising and shifting customer expectations, suggesting that on the one hand, there is it's difficult to predict customer demand. On the other hand, there is a lot of pressure to increase service level. Significant increase in labor cost in developing countries. To illustrate this, the data that I have here suggests that labor cost in China over the last 5 to 8 years increased year over year on average by 19%. In Mexico, the annual increase on average is about 5%, and in the US is by about 3%. So if a specific company took production sourcing decisions 5, 8 years ago, they may need to revisit some or all of these decisions. Not only a significant increase in labor cost in developing countries in the last few years, but also significant change in logistics cost. To give us an insight to what I'm referring to here, I collected data on U.S. logistics cost as a percentage of the U.S. GDP over the last 25 years. As you can see, between 1984 and 2003, U.S. logistics cost as a percentage of the U.S. GDP went continuously down. But between 2003 and 2008, U.S. logistics cost increased and increased significantly. In 2009, it went down. It's clear because of what? Because of the recession, and now it's starting to go up again. And we understand where the increase, let me try to see, where the increase in logistics costs is coming from. It's in part due to energy prices. Between 2003 and today, oil price more than tripled. It's in part because of limited rail capacity in the U.S., suggesting not only that rail transportation cost goes up, but also implying that companies, shippers, start shifting shipment from rail to the trucking industry. As a result, transportation cost in general goes up. In addition to this huge increase in the level of risk, just in breakfast today, my somebody who works with me at MIT, who is here, pointed out to an article in the Financial Times that basically reads like as follows. It says, PC prices to rise as technology company pass on costs of the Thailand flood to their customers. And if you think about events that have happened just in the last 2 years, they suggest enormous risks faced by many companies. This is exemplified by the disruption in Japan in March of this year. Another example is the volcano eruption in Iceland last year, flood in Thailand just this month. And we understand why companies face higher level of risk right now. One way to understand this is to tie this to successful strategies that companies have used in the last 5 to 10 years around what is called lean manufacturing, outsourcing, and offshoring. One impact of lean strategies is reduction in inventory level. But reduction in inventory level implies that if there is a disruption, the supply chain will not be able to match supply with demand effectively. Similarly, outsourcing and offshoring implies that the supply chain is geographically more diverse, as a result, exposed to all sorts of potential problems. And so if you think about sources of risk, clearly there are many, many different sources of risk that companies need to at least be aware of. What I'm listing here are a couple of examples. You can see that I organize them very carefully. At the top, I have what we can refer to as unknown unknown. These are sources of risk from which we have very little data. Therefore, it's difficult to build probabilistic models. That's why I call them the unknown unknown, or these are the sources of risk. In some sense, we can think about as uncontrollable. At the bottom, I have the known unknown. These are sources of risk like market changes, supplier performance, execution problems. You have a lot of data, you can build models. Therefore, in some sense, you can think about them as controllable. Controllable or uncontrollable, companies need to think carefully about these sources of risk and build mitigation strategies that allow them to respond very effectively when problems occur. One way to think about these sources of risk is to think about this simple framework, where on the x-coordinate, I have the ability to control from the unknown unknown to the known unknown, and on the y-coordinate, I have expected impacts, right? Most companies focus on the known unknown with high expected impact. That's natural because they have a lot of data. They can build strategies that allow them to deal with this type of sources of risk very effectively. But a lot of companies ignore or don't deal very well with the unknown unknown with high expected impact. And one of the arguments that they make, what can we do? A volcano eruption in Iceland happens once every 200 years. And so it's hard for us to even think about these types of sources of risk and prepare for these types of events. Of course, volcano eruption happens once every 200 years. An earthquake happens with another frequency. Whatever you look at, we don't know what will happen in the next 12 months, but you know that most supply chain will be exposed to some sort of disruptions in the next 12 months. As a result, building a strategy that takes into account both the unknown unknown and the known unknown becomes very important. Other changes that companies consider right now include sustainability. The idea is that either because of regulation or because of corporate social responsibilities, companies are starting to build into their strategies constraints or the impact of sustainability on their business. And finally, probably the most important change in the last 2 to 3 years is the huge volatility in the market. And here I don't only refer to volatility in demand, I more refer to volatility in supply, in particular commodity prices. And this is nicely illustrated with a couple of examples. So here I'm looking at oil price. And I have data here on oil price over a period of about 20 years. What I'm doing, I am measuring for every year the number of days the price of oil change up or down at least 5%. As you can see, in normal years, the number of days the price of oil change up or down at least 5% is 5 days, 10 days, no more than 15 days. But in 2008, the number of days the price of oil change up or down at least 5% is 39 days. And the last time we saw that level of volatility was in 1990. What happened at that time? Does somebody remember? This is the first Gulf War. This is the previous recession that hit North America, especially the U.S. And so volatility at that time was enormous. And if you ask what just happened in the last 2 years, between the beginning of 2009 and the beginning of 2011, the price of oil more than doubled. And this is not only about the price of oil. This is, in fact, about the price of almost any commodity. If you look at the price of steel over time, if you look at the price of different types of iron over time, enormous volatility in the market. And so if you are an executive managing your own business, managing your own supply chain, you are faced with competition in an environment that is highly uncertain, that is dynamically changing, that is extremely complex. And the last thing that many of these companies think about is building risk mitigation strategies into their business plans. The problem is that at some point they are hit with a disruption like what I just read, and then they face with problem. And of course, those companies that have been able to respond very effectively have been able to gain competitive advantage. And so the question is, how do you build risk thinking into the business strategy without enormously increasing cost, right? Without significantly increasing your own cost. And this is the focus of the two sections that I'm going to describe, managing the unknown unknown and managing the known unknown, or the concept of redundancy and flexibility. And so to start with redundancy, let me show you a case study. Very intuitive case study, but it reveals an important concept and a clear insight. So this is a company, a manufacturer in the consumer packaged goods industry. They have lots of product. They have a global network with 40 manufacturing facilities all over the world. New management arrived and they decided to try and cut costs in their business. One way to cut costs is to close plants, what we call it, to rationalize the manufacturing strategy. But they also realize that as they close manufacturing facilities, they will start increasing risk. And the question was, what is the right trade-off between cutting costs and managing risk effectively? Here is their business before making any change, what we call the baseline. You can see here the 40 plants. They have manufacturing facilities in North America, in Europe, in Latin America, in Africa, and in Asia. For example, in Asia, they have plants in Thailand, India, Vietnam, China, Malaysia. You name a reasonable country, they have manufacturing facilities there. So the question is, how much capacity, how many plants can they close, and what is the impact on bottom line? It's not difficult to present this as a simple optimization problem, and this optimization problem suggests that if they close 17 plants and move from 40 manufacturing facility to 23 manufacturing facility, they will cut cost by $40 million. And these $40 million go straight into bottom line. One way to appreciate this is to ask yourself by how much you need to increase revenue in order to have the same impact on bottom line, by many multipliers of $40 million. So clearly this is very attractive. Closing 17 plants and moving down from 40 to 23 is very attractive, except that just when you look at this picture, you realize that if they go in this direction, enormous potential risk. And this comes from two observations. The first one is notice that in this design, in this optimized network, there is no plant either in North America or in Europe. This means very long lead time to the key market areas, exposing the supply chain to all sorts of potential problems. The second issue is illustrated by the red bars here. Red bars illustrate capacity utilization. The higher the bar, the higher the utilization. Notice that almost all the plants in this design are up to capacity. What does this mean? It means that if there is a disruption because of geopolitical risk in Thailand, because of a flood in Vietnam, because of an earthquake in Latin America, or because of a pandemic in China, this supply chain will not be able to match supply with demand, right? And the problem is, how should they think about this type of disruptions, this type of sources of risks, in order to identify what is an effective supply chain strategy? The typical way of dealing with these types of sources of risk, because we don't have a lot of data, is to do what you can call scenario analysis. You try to come up with all sorts of scenarios and compare the effectiveness of your supply chain, your business strategy, against each one of the scenarios. There are two problems with scenario analysis. The first one is that you need to be creative enough to come up with all the scenarios. It's not simple. And the second one is, even if you are able to come up with all the different scenarios, what you will find is that there is one worst case scenario that determines your supply chain strategy. You really don't want one scenario to determine the entire business strategy. So the question is, if I cannot use scenario analysis, what can I do? To see what you can do, let's look at this graph. In this graph, I am on the x-coordinate presenting the number of plants that we keep in the supply chain, right? So when I say here 40, I mean that I close no facility. If I say here 30, it means that I close 10 and keep 30. 10 means that I close 30 and keep 10. The y-coordinate represents cost. You can see that I basically include all the relevant costs in this business: inventory, taxation, duties and tariffs, transportation cost, fixed cost, variable production cost. The key line is the line at the top. The line at the top represents total supply chain cost. It suggests that if you want to squeeze as much out of your supply chain, you should close 17 facilities, keep 23. This will give us a saving of $40 million. But notice something very important, and this is always true, and this is where we use mathematics to prove that this is always true. Total supply chain cost is always flat around the optimal strategy. Well, if it's always flat around the optimal strategy, You really don't need to select the optimal strategy. It's enough to select a strategy where you keep 7 additional facilities in the supply chain. Put differently, you close only 10 plants and you keep 30. And if you do that, then you lose only $2.5 million out of the $40 million potential savings. So if you ask this company, what did you do to cut costs? They will say, we closed 10 facilities, and as a result, we save $37.5 million. If you ask them, what did you do to manage risk? They say, we basically invested in an option. The option are the 7 additional plants that we kept open that otherwise we would have closed. You ask them, what is the cost of this option? They tell you exactly, it's $2.5 million. It's the savings that we could have achieved, but we are not achieving because of the risk mitigation strategy. So this is one way of taking advantage of characteristics of the business to build into the business risk thinking. The second, and so this rule that I say here is that supply chain cost is flat around the optimal strategy. This is a rule that is always true, that works independent of whether the company is a global company or whether it's in North America or whether it's in Asia. And this brings us to talk about flexibility and managing the known unknown. And again, when you talk to executives who think about their business, because of all the complexity and the changes that they have seen in the last few years, executives talk about flexibility, but it's not clear even what they mean when they talk about flexibility. So what I want to start with is a definition of flexibility, just to have consistency in the discussion. And then I'll illustrate a concept that hopefully will convince you that if you do rigorous analysis, mathematics can suggest an extremely effective strategy. So here is my definition of flexibility. I define flexibility as the ability to respond to change, and change can come in many different ways. It can be change in demand volume or demand mix, commodity prices, labor costs, exchange rate, whatever is appropriate in your business. And we would like to be able to respond to change without increasing response time. It's one thing if I can respond to change in 2 days. It's a different story if I can respond to change in 2 weeks. And we would like to be able to respond to change without increasing response time, without increasing cost, while effectively matching supply with demand, and while utilizing capacity effectively. In general, there are 3 ways to achieve flexibility: through product design, process design, and system design. By product design, I refer to strategies that have been used in the high-tech industry, like standard components, modular product architecture. By process design, it's more referred to lean types of strategies, like a flexible workforce and cross-training. I am going to focus here on achieving flexibility through system design. Is there a way to design your system, the manufacturing network itself, so that it's very flexible? So let's see what are we trying to do when we focus on flexibility through system design. I'm trying to focus on a couple of objectives. One, on total cost, including manufacturing and transportation. The second is, no matter what changes in the market we see, I am trying to match available supply with market demand, and I'm trying to utilize resources effectively. Here is the key idea. On the left-hand side, you see what I call no flexibility or dedicated manufacturing strategy. I have 5 plants, 5 product family. Each plant is dedicated to one product family. Clearly, there is no flexibility here. But the advantage of a strategy like this, while there is no flexibility, the advantage is that it allows a company to reduce manufacturing cost. Why? Because lot sizes are very large. You can produce large quantities. and so you can reduce cost. There are very few setups, meaning you don't have to change frequently from one product to another. As a result, you reduce manufacturing cost. By contrast, in full flexibility, each plant is capable of producing all product families. So clearly, on a very intuitive level, full flexibility allows you to better match supply with demand when demand is different than the forecast, right? But there is one issue with full flexibility. It increases manufacturing cost. Why? Because you have to switch very frequently from one product to another. Lot sizes are very small, so manufacturing cost goes up significantly. One advantage of full flexibility is that it allows you to reduce transportation costs because on average you are closer to market demand. Put differently, each market can be served from the closest facility. The problem with full flexibility is that it's very expensive to implement because you need to make sure that each plant is capable of producing all product families. And so a company may want to consider partial flexibility. For example, in two flexibility, each plant is capable of producing two product families, or in three flexibility, each plant is capable of producing three product families. Here is the amazing thing about the concept I'm going to show you. The amazing thing, and you can prove this in a very rigorous way, that if you design carefully partial flexibility, you can achieve with this almost everything that full flexibility can achieve, which is extremely surprising. How come with just small investment in flexibility, I can achieve everything that this can achieve? Now, to show you how powerful this concept is, before I go into the key insight, this idea does not have to be plants and products. This can be people and tasks. So think about call centers, think about banks, where you are trying to decide how many different skills, how many different tasks each person in your team needs to have. This is, each one is dedicated to one task. This is each person can do everything. This will show, as I will argue in a few minutes, that if you let every person have just a few skills, you can be as effective as the full flexibility strategy. So the really the question here, whether it's true that small investment in flexibility is very powerful, and if it's true, where is the effectiveness coming from? To show you where it's coming from and whether it's true, let me take you through another case study. This is a manufacturer in the food and beverage industry. The company has five plants and five product families. Their current strategy is completely dedicated, meaning each plant is dedicated to one product family. Capacity utilization, they use on average about 90% of the available capacity. The 10% remaining capacity is used when demand is different than the forecast, so that they match supply with demand effectively. They realize, because of the changes in the market in the last few years, that this strategy is not effective. The question was, what can we do? One answer is to build more inventory. For this company, more inventory is not effective because their product has a very short life cycle. Another strategy is to build more capacity. This is very expensive, so they rejected this. And a third strategy is to use, just intuitively, time as a buffer. Instead of telling the customer, we will respond in 2 days, you respond in 2 weeks. This is not a competitive strategy. And that's where the discussion on flexibility came from. The question was, how much flexibility, where do we need to invest in flexibility, and what is the potential benefit of flexibility? Here is some more information about the company. Five plants: Pittsburgh, Dayton, Ohio, Texas, Omaha, and California. The number on the right-hand side represent labor cost. You can see that from labor cost point of view, the plant in Dayton, Ohio is a least cost facility, and the one in California is the high cost facility. There are 8 distribution centers, 8 warehouses. We are not going to change the distribution strategy, so they remain the same. And finally, the transportation strategy is very simple. Large trucks to ship from plants to warehouses, and smaller trucks to ship from warehouses to retail outlets. Just to get an insight about this company, the customers are all over the country. You can see the dot. Dot represent. What do you think dot represent? I'm not giving you a lot of information. What can they represent? Dots, this is just it, what?
Sales,
exactly. The size of the dot is proportional to volume of sales in generating this different location. Different colors of states represent population density. The stronger the color, the higher the density. So you can see that, as you would expect in this industry, there is a direct correlation between volume of sales and population density. A little bit more about the current strategy. Remember, it's dedicated. Not only it's dedicated, the color code here suggests that the high volume product, which is product one, is produced in the low cost facility in Dayton, Ohio, and the low volume product, which is product five, is produced in the high cost facility in California. Everything in the current strategy is trying to minimize total manufacturing costs. Dedicated manufacturing strategy, large volume, assignment of product to the different plants to minimize production costs. So we analyze basically five strategies. Baseline, don't change anything. Two, flexibility. Each plant need to be able to produce only two product families. Average flexibility or three flexibility, all the way to full flexibility. You understand that as we increase the degree of flexibility, the initial investment required to reconfigure the network increases, right? But maybe it's an investment worth making because you need for this company a higher degree of flexibility. So let's build some intuition about the impact of flexibility. You can see at the top the different strategies, baseline to flexibility all the way to full flexibility. Here are the warehouses. Bars represent transportation cost. The longer the bar, the higher the transportation cost. You can see, just by looking at this picture, that as we invest in more and more flexibility, this bar becomes shorter and shorter, suggesting that flexibility reduces transportation cost. And we understand why this is the case. For example, in the baseline, product five is shipped to a warehouse in Baltimore from a plant in California, whereas in two flexibility, this warehouse receives the product from a much closer facility, the plant in Omaha. Of course, as you build more and more flexibility, while transportation cost goes down, manufacturing cost increases. You can see this here. Here is the baseline, two flexibility all the way to full flexibility. The orange line represents transportation cost. It goes down with the degree of flexibility. The blue line in the middle represents manufacturing cost. It goes up with flexibility. The question is, what is the net effect? At the top, I have total supply, total business cost, not including the cost to reconfigure the network. So think about this as annual cost. You can see that full flexibility allows us to reduce total cost, supply chain cost, by 13%. But notice that this curve suggests something very similar to what we saw before, decreasing marginal returns. In fact, it suggests that just investing in two flexibility give us 80% of the benefit of full flexibility. So when we showed this to the company, they said, well, maybe from cost point of view, two flexibility is very effective, but maybe we need to invest in a higher degree of flexibility in order to match supply with demand when demand is different than the forecast. And so to find out whether this is the case, we asked the company to generate a list of scenarios where demand is different than the forecast, and they came up with a long list. Here are three examples. In scenario one, demand for product one and two increased significantly, and demand for the other product decreased. In scenario two, demand for product four and five increase, and demand for the other product decrease, and so forth and so on. So there is a long list of scenarios. Of course, we cannot design the supply chain for individual scenario because we don't know which scenario will materialize. So I'm going to design the supply chain based on the forecast and then test the effectiveness of each design against all the scenarios. and I did this here, and you can see here, scenario one, scenario two, scenario three. I'm for now comparing two design, baseline to two flexibility. And I'm comparing them from four performance measures point of view. How much of the demand I can satisfy? Shortfall, how much of the demand I lose because somehow I don't have the right capacity? The cost per unit sold and plant utilization, and you can see scenario by scenario that two flexibility satisfy more demand. The shortfall, meaning the amount of demand that we lose, is huge in the baseline, but it's zero in two flexibility. If the focus is on matching supply with demand, this says you don't need more than two flexibility. Cost per unit goes down, plant utilization goes up, and this is true everywhere. And an observation you can make here is that, notice that in the baseline, we lose a lot of demand, but average utilization of the plant is very low. We lose a lot of demand and average utilization of plants is very low. How is it possible that in the baseline we lose many customers, yet the plants are not working at capacity? Does the question make sense? Of course, the capacity in the baseline and the capacity in two flexibility are exactly the same, but I have the wrong capacity in the baseline. As a result, I lose many customers. So the question is, where is the power of two flexibility coming from? To see where the power of two flexibility coming from, let's look at the baseline versus two flexibility. Different colors represent different products. You can see that in the baseline, Pittsburgh is responsible for the green product, whatever it is. Oma is responsible for the orange product. Modesto is responsible for the purpose product. And in the bottom, at the bottom I have the two flexibility strategy. Each plant has two colors. When you look at this, you ask yourself, why this coloring scheme is very effective? One way to understand why this coloring scheme is very effective is to look at the same design, but using a simple bipartite graph. What I have here are the plants and the product. A link connecting a product to a plant means that this plant produces this product. You can see that this design is equivalent to this graph because on the left-hand side I have Pittsburgh responsible for orange and green, and on the right I have Pittsburgh responsible for orange and green. On the left I have Omaha responsible for purple and orange. On the right I have Omaha responsible for purple and orange. And the same is true for all the other ones. But when you look at the right-hand side, you see something very insightful that explains the effectiveness of two flexibility. What is it? Why, when you look at the right-hand side, you see really the power of two flexibility? I created something that explains why two flexibility design is powerful. Can somebody see that? Anybody? Just help me a little bit. So what I did here, you can see that I really created a domino effect. I created a long chain connecting all the products to all the plants. This long chain implies that if there is a problem here, I can fix it by making a change here. So it's this. One way to think about this, those of you who have background in linear programming can see it immediately. What I did, I basically created a strategy where I can make changes in different parts of my business to affect a problem that appears somewhere else. To show you that indeed this is the case, let's compare this strategy, this two flexibility strategy, with another strategy that has again, two flexibility, but creating multiple short chains. And you can see it here. This is the long chain that I just described. And this is another strategy with two short chains. You can see each plant has two colors. But now you have one short chain, and here is another short chain. And intuitively, it's easy to understand that this long chain is much more effective than the collection of short chains. And then I'll show you that this is true with the data. So why is a long chain is better than a collection of short chains? Suppose everybody is working at capacity, right? And somebody told you that demand for product 3 increased by 1 unit and demand for product 1 decreased by 1 unit. In the long chain design, what you can do is the following. Because demand for product 1 decreased by 1 unit, I can decrease the amount of product 1 produced in Dayton, increase the amount of product 4 produced in Dayton, decrease the amount of product 4 produced in Amarillo, and therefore satisfy the extra demand for product 3 from production in this plant. I can do it here because of this domino effect, but I really cannot do it here in the short chain strategy. And amazingly, the data says that this is always true. The data says that if I compare among the three scenarios, the long chain strategy to short chain, the long chain satisfies more demand, shortfall is zero in the long chain, but it's very high in the short chain. Cost per unit is down in the long chain, and plant utilization is up. And in fact, you can show that all this, which is amazing, come from one characteristic, which is called supermodularity. You can prove that flow in this network, independent of whether it's deterministic or stochastic, always supermodular. And this supermodularity is also, if you have background in optimization, can see that this supermodularity property basically shows that this is true in general. And so just to finish, I implemented this at a division of Pepsi. This division of Pepsi is a $15 billion division, mostly in North America. In North America, they have 50 plants and about 300 distribution centers, 7 business units. Each business unit has a number of plants, a number of distribution centers, and is responsible for satisfying demand in a specific region. Transportation cost is a large part of the total cost, and there is a lot of focus on service. I started working with them in 2006. They said consumer preference is shifting from carbonated to non-carbonated drinks and from cans to bottles. But they said, we produce this newly preferred product in limited number of plants. As a result, we have a dedicated manufacturing strategy, therefore huge service problems during period of peak demand. We implemented the strategy that I just devised, this small investment in flexibility in their business. And what I want to show you in the next slide, which will be my last slide, is a press release that Pepsi published 2 years after the implementation was completed. So this is not about potential benefit, this is not about estimate, this is a Pepsi reporting what was the impact of flexibility on their business. So they said it helped us bring together sales, marketing, finance, operations to talk about our strategy, nothing special about this. It says it reduced our raw material cost by $6 million. This is a $15 billion division. $6 million reduction in cost is nothing impressive. It reduces transportation cost by 2 percentage points. That's very important. But then they said, forget about all this. Here is the key impact. It provided us with an additional 12 million cases available to be sold due to reduction in out of stock due to the increased service level. And if you ask what does this mean, they said this reduction in warehouse out of stock effectively added 1.5 production line worth of capacity to the firm supply chain without any capital investment. Basically, without any change in their business, they got the impact of as if they invested in another plant, right? This is basically the insight that comes out of this case study. And the technical work that we have done shows that indeed small investment in flexibility, like 2 flexibility, because of the super modularity, gives you almost everything that full flexibility provides. And I will stop here. It's too early in the morning. Yes. So the key constraint is I don't want plants to be making too many products, okay? Because that requires reconfiguring each plant, and that requires a lot of investment. So a business constraint that I add is each plant will produce no more than two. And if the optimizer select, here is a plant that will focus on one, and here is a plant that will focus on two, I don't mind. What the mathematics shows is that when you do that, two is better than two and ones. Similarly, if you say three, then the constraint is no more than three. And then you want to argue, you know, if it's no more than three, it's going to be three. Yes. So I'm not sure I'm following. Give me a little bit more insight. Short delivery time. Yes. I see. So if demand for all the products is very high, then there is nothing. What this does, it tries to take advantage of, in some sense, risk pooling. Try to take advantage of variation. Some product demand is high, other product, and as a result, I am going to allocate production to take advantage of this. If everybody is moving up at the same time, then it's exactly what you just said. Then each plant is going to be dedicated to one product, and that's it. There's nothing else I can do. So this is
a great point.
One corollary of this discussion is that if energy price increases significantly, which means the transportation cost increases significantly, this says that more flexibility is more effective from both transportation cost point of view and sustainability point of view. Because sustainability is directly related to transportation costs, and in the business professional book, I report a case where we implemented flexibility in Europe, and in Europe the regulations are much tighter than in North America, and the main motivation was not volatility; it was your point about the high energy price. I'm here. No problem. Yes.
On a plane.
There is no magic about the number two when I say two flexibility. It really depends how much variability you want to incorporate in your business plan. The more variability that you want to incorporate, the higher the degree of flexibility. But the conclusion that I just said is always true, which says that you still only need partial flexibility. You don't need a lot of flexibility in order to incorporate, in order to deal with high level of variability. But your point is, there is no magic about two flexibility. Sometimes you need three, other times you need four. When I told you about the Pepsi story, two flexibility was not necessarily the optimal one. But it was very small investment in flexibility.
Yeah, I think you get the flow with
Exactly.
I think the number you have probably depend on the volatility of the demand.
Exactly. But what you get here is something a little bit more than just the number. What you get here are two important principles, in addition to small investment flexibility. One is you want to create always, doesn't matter whether it's two, three, or four, a chaining effect. Chaining is very important. And the second thing that I didn't go into details here, but comes out of the supermodularity, is not only chaining is very important, but closing the chain is very important. That is to say, that's really direct consequences, consequence of the supermodularity, is that as I add more arcs to the chain, the marginal benefit is increasing, and the biggest impact is when I do implement the last arc in the network. Does this make sense? So chaining is important, and closing is even more important. So it's small degree of flexibility, it's creating chains, and it is closing the chain. So when you think about energy supply, you think about procurement flexibility, not this type of flexibility that I talked about. In energy, what because of the volatility in price, because of volatility in supply, the applicable strategy are flexibility that achieve from flexible contracts between the buyer and the supplier. And flexible contracts are very similar to what you will see in financial investment. They are all about portfolio of contracts, and they are a lot about what we call option contracts. An option contract are like financial options where you say, look, the volatility is so remarkable in this market that I'm going to commit to a certain amount, and then I pay the full price. And then I'm going to also buy an option on another quantity, and I will execute it only if demand or supply are in certain parameters. And so it's a different types of flexibility, but this are concepts that have been used in energy and oil procurement.
Okay, excellent. So next, we will.